Tonight, we dedicate our program, Resiliency, to one of our group, Darla Barkley. She contributed her last piece for this show.
This is resilience, according to Bob Dylan. Forever young. May God bless you and keep you always. May your wishes all come true. May you always do for others and let others do for you. May you build a ladder to the stars and climb on every rung. May you stay forever young, forever young, forever young. May you stay forever young. I'd be willing to bet that if any of us could choose the kind of resilience we wanted, a big chunk would say to be young again, in Paris, in Italy, in Stump Jump, Alaska. In fact, Happy Birthday might be replaced in restaurants and parties with Dylan's more practical wish. There's a makeup called Resilient. People praise perseverance and pluck, and we all admire the guy in the movies who gets up, dusts himself off, and rushes back into the fight. Even a cat, let's call him Fernando Dos, has resilience. No matter how many times one may bat him off one's head, he purrs like sling blade and springs right back. Or maybe that cat is just practicing the neurotic form of resilience. No matter. Today, we Mind's Eyers will use our hard-earned skills to muse on the skill of the bounce back. Hang on. We'll be back.
Tonight, we dedicate our program to one of our group, Darla Barkley. In the words of her daughter, Danielle, on January 23rd, Mom took her final breath at 11:40 a.m. She went very quickly and painlessly and quite peacefully. The cardinal that has been watching her from the window flew off with her last breath. Earlier in January, she was being helped by hospice in her home. I picked her up for an appointment that she hoped would ease her pain. While she was being treated, I wrote the poem saying goodbye. I am here with you for radiation therapy. When you accidentally see your reflection in the window, bursting into uncontrollable sobs until the technician wheels you away. I stare out the window, my heart frozen like the lake outside, my eyes fill with tears. Dearest friend, risk taker, lover of life, your spunky heart filled with love. You are a joy. I'm thankful for your spirit and all the days we enjoyed together. Sculpture in nature's garden, brown branches spread outward, bending in the breeze, saying goodbye.
When talk turns to perseverance or resilience, many people who've not been sorely tested wonder about their own courage or elasticity in the face of terrible news or misfortune. How will we wonder, react to that look on the doctor's face when he has to do what is one of his least favorite jobs, delivering grave news? A medical dictionary defines resilience thus: the capability of a strained body to recover its size and shape after deformation caused especially by compressive stress, or, two, an ability to recover from or adjust easily to misfortune or change. That's resilience. Deformation? Strained body? Who will bounce back or who will snap? Darla Barclay has some wisdom to impart on this question.
On the subject of resilience, let me introduce you to Bozo the Clown, the inflatable toy that my children punched and played with for hours at a time. Sand in his round bottom weighted him down and enabled him to bounce back up for the next punch. Throughout my life, I have pictured myself as this toy. Punch me, and I bounce back up. I bounced back from my divorce after 20 years of marriage. I bounced back after each subsequent love affair flamed and fizzled. I was even able to bounce back, although in slow motion, after my son committed suicide. In August this year, when I was told that I have stage 3 esophageal cancer, I felt myself go down for the count. But like Bozo, I rebounded. "Tell me," I said, "what are my options?" The doctor responded, "Cure, that is cancer-free for 5 years, can only happen if you have chemotherapy and radiation simultaneously for 4 months. Whew, I am much more of an alternative medicine person. But the word cure packs a powerful wallop, and as I looked at my daughter and grandchildren, I thought, I can do this. Treatment began on September 21st, 5 days of chemotherapy, 24 hours a day from a pump encased in a fanny pack around my waist. Each day, I also went for radiation treatment. By the third day, the side effects began. Nausea, fatigue, sores in my mouth and throat, and lips peeling like old paint at the end of summer. "You'll bounce back in a couple of days," said the radiation technician. Oh, how I wanted to believe him. But each day was worse than the previous one. Chills began racking my body. My temperature spiked to over 102 degrees many times a day. "Infection," said the oncologist. "You will have to go into the hospital." 5 days of torturous intravenous feedings and multiple infusions of antibiotics. 4 separate blood draws for cultures that refused to give up the secrets of what was going on inside my body. As I awakened on Sunday morning a week ago, I realized that all the air had been knocked out of me. I lay crumpled on the hospital bed like a deflated Bozo. My life essence was drifting away from me. I cried and apologized to my body for allowing this brutal assault and promised that if it would help me bounce back, I wouldn't let it happen again. Monday evening, I was back home in my own bed. Slowly, very slowly, I feel the strength of my body returning. Supported by the love and tender care of my friends and family, I am standing upright more and more often. I am bouncing back. I will triumph over this cancer in my own way, following my own belief system, which does not include chemotherapy and radiation. This quote from Shambhala, "The Sacred Path of the Warrior," sustains me. Even in the worst of situations, you can still make your life elegant. For Mind's Eye Radio, this is Darla Barclay.
Darla wrote incredible children's stories, two of which editors still have and are reviewing. Zoe Petunia, Max the Magnificent, stories about animals, stories, yes, with spunky characters and humor, but grounded in Darla's knowledge and factually correct. This amazing woman shared her deep knowledge of animals with children at the zoo school, her love of the natural world at Olbrich Gardens, and her deep knowledge of modern art with children in Madison, but also shared her knowledge with children from many years earlier in her birth state and longtime residence, California. A year ago in January, she finished the first draft of her memoir on her son, Tommy, an architecturally skillful, strong and powerful memoir, weaving her young son's sweetness and growing up and how he got to the point where she found him after he killed himself. She wrote this book for herself and to ease the way for other parents who find themselves in that difficult place. She finished that first draft on the 25th anniversary of his death in January 2009. Less than a month ago, she was working on revisions, preparing it for publication. She also chose this quotation by Helen Hayes to include in the memoir. Quote, "As a knot appears unexpectedly in a thread, so disappointments block the smoothness of life. If a few deft strokes can untangle the skein, life continues evenly. But if it cannot be corrected, then it must be quietly woven into the design. Thus the finished piece can still be beautiful, though not perfect as planned." Quote. One of her favorite books in the last months of her life was The Tao of Pooh by Benjamin Huff. In Darla's copy, one sentence is circled in the foreword in response to Pooh's asking what the book is about. "It's about how to stay happy and calm under all circumstances." Thanks to Flora Van Warmer for playing the bass. On behalf of all of us from Mind's Eye Radio, we dedicate this program to the memory and spirit of our friend and colleague, Darla Barclay. This is Judith Zuckerman for Mind's Eye Radio.
Norma Gay Pruitt dwelled under the illusion that she had it, that bounce that brings one back. But now she thinks maybe passive acceptance has something going for it, too.
Sometimes life is just a bowl of cherry juice. I say this because cherry juice is one of the few folk remedies that actually may have an effect on the medieval disease called gout. And if you have gout, as I do, you are willing to try most anything to ease the rat-chewing on your feet searing pain, as an ancient medical book illustrates it. I am literally being pierced in the soft tissue surrounding my joints with needle-sharp crystals formed by the excess of uric acid that causes gouty arthritis. The slight weight of a cotton sheet on my foot is excruciating. I have crawled on the floor and rolled myself around in a desk chair using a cane to clear the path. Did I mention that I have none of the habits associated with causing gout? What I do have is impaired elimination function and bad statistical luck. 95% of sufferers are old men. I may be older, but last time I looked, I'm pretty sure I'm not a man. And I turned out to be the rare person who is allergic to both of the ancient medications that normally control gout. But enough of the problem. What about the comeback? What does it take to come back from a bout with gout? It takes resilience, that's what. So I wasn't surprised when I did eventually find ways to bounce back, given that my little red rubber ball of resilience is a little flatter than it used to be, so the bounce is not quite as quick or high. But life is also serendipitous, and while I have been mulling this topic of resilience for some time, and a body might say my subconscious was primed to find material about it, I was still a little surprised and a lot pleased when, suffering insomnia one night, my glance fell upon the open AARP magazine. The article, by Beth Howard, was called "The Secrets of Resilient People," and it came with a little quiz. No academic can resist a quiz, so I am taking it and offering it to you here. The code is 5 equals strongly agree, down to 1 equals do not agree. Number 1, I'm usually upbeat. I'm chewing on my pencil. I have to answer 4, since I am upbeat, except when I have the gout, which would make Mother Teresa swear like a pirate. Number 2, I can tolerate high levels of ambiguity and uncertainty about situations. Oh dear, I'm not so sure I understand the question. It's not clear. Help, I want to get this one right. Could you restate the question, please? Okay. I'll go with a 3. Number 3, I adapt quickly to new developments. Oh, I really hate that new development that is being put up down the street, and I detest urban sprawl. What? Oh, never mind. I'll give it a safe 3. Number 4, I find humor in rough situations and can laugh at myself. Well, does being able to laugh at other people count for anything? Okay, I'll get a 4. Number 5, I learn valuable lessons from my experiences. Yes, I learned that you can't teach a cat to jump over a cane while lying down in bed with gout. And from hours of cartoons, I learned that Roadrunner always senses the anvil tossed off the cliff just before it squishes him. Roadrunner gets a 5 for this one. Me? I'm not so sure cat cane jumping ranks as a valuable lesson. Number 6. I'm good at solving problems. Well, depends on whether they are word problems or math problems. And if math problems, do they involve solving for X or Y? If the former, I get a 5. In the latter case, I get a negative 5. 7. I'm strong and durable. Absolutely, when I don't have gout, which severely lowers my average. Number 8. I've converted misfortunes into good luck and found benefits in bad experiences. Let's see. Is this throwing bad money after good? Does it involve gambling? Please repeat the question more clearly. So, how did you all do on the resiliency quiz? I'm having trouble with the math myself, and that is making me grumpy. Whether I can pass the quiz or not, I do know someone who can, Max Cleland. This is the ex-senator from Georgia who was hounded from office by Bush, Rove, and Company most unfairly, even after Cleland, while serving his country, was blown asunder by a blundering fellow soldier and suffered the loss of parts of both legs and part of one arm. So this triple amputee, in order to have some kind of sex life, engaged in phone sex with a woman planted to entrap him by political enemies and exposed in a most tawdry fashion, though he was not married at the time and wasn't hurting anyone. But back to resilience. It seems that Cleland was able to rise above his serious trauma while serving as senator, but once he lost his Senate seat, plunged into a serious depression complicated by post-traumatic stress syndrome. So how is he resilient? Well, he has written a book, actually a 4th book, called Heart of a Patriot, How I Found the Courage to Survive Vietnam, Walter Reed, and Karl Rove. And whether it sells or not, he proclaims that he just could not stay in that darkest of places. I heard him on NPR and began to weep at the injustice, but also the wonder that he, of all people, made a comeback. It makes a pain in the foot seem almost a blessing. At least I have a foot to stand on and feel pain in. Though I dangle my prepositions, I can also dangle my foot in the sweet waters of the lake nearby. I can walk a block sometimes and not have searing pain. I can take stairs like a baby, one down, the other down, repeat till I get to the bottom. I ride my bike and it hurts a little less. In short, which I am, I found my bounce back again and again. I roll a little better because I don't literally have to roll around for the rest of my life, unlike Max Cleland and millions of others. My mom, who had resilience if anybody did, used to tell me when I was whining about some small irritant that probably wasn't worth a bucket of warm spit, "At least you are not buried up to your neck in mud." And I wasn't, and I'm not, and that, my friends, is that. This is Norma Gay Pruitt, literally rolling with the punches, for Mind's Eye Radio.
While some of us are convinced that Gaia has had enough of us humans, and like the mother leopard will cuff us off and send us reeling when we've pushed her past all endurance, we only have to observe non-human nature to agree that of all persistent phenomenon, nature comes back. And Fran Rawl has noticed just that.
What is resilience? Is it the Japanese maple tree outside, which is glowing a bright orange, even though there's very gray light and no sun? Is it getting up off the couch to type this, even though I had no ideas? Maybe it's the reverse of one of the seven deadly sins, sloth. Maybe it's the fact that 3/4 of the evergreen slips my enthusiastic gardener planted up where I didn't want them, all in a heap. And so now I have to dig them up, or do I pot each one and present them to friends as a gift they don't want? Is resilience shoving up from that couch and going out to prance at folk dancing, even though one gets slower each year, and going to gym when others are coming out with canes and splints and knowing I might be the next to be splinted? Is it the white-throated sparrows, which come on schedule each spring and fall, noted down in my book as having arrived at that time last year and the year before that? It's the new little business, starting up right where the last one failed. It's deciding to call up the UPS people to say they delivered a package to the wrong house, ours, or just deciding to deliver it ourselves or call the intended. Which is more trouble and more resilient? Is it starting a new relationship when the last one went belly up? Is it holding on through thick and thin? No, that's stubbornness. Is a resilient mind just a stubborn blob of gray jello repeating and repeating? When it goes good, they say, that's great, he persevered. And when it goes bad, people say, well, I could have told him that wouldn't work. I could go on, and I will. Is it writing to people who don't write back just because you want to communicate? Is the world keeping on going just because God intended it to? Or is it just resilient, like a wristwatch, rewinding by a turn of the wrist? Should I keep on typing, even though many letters are not showing so well? Thank you very much, China. Wasn't it enough that the ribbons keep getting shorter? All these things I ponder and try to look up spelling. This is Fran Rawl, still breathing for Mind's Eye Radio.
You keep saying you got something for me. Something you call love, but confess. You've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin'. And now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. Yeah.
Sometimes what looks to be a cul-de-sac in one's plans turns right back onto the highway of success, or so surmises John Morgan.
This is a true story as told to me by a friend. Somewhere in the heart of Tennessee, Holly is a Janesville girl, Janesville, Wisconsin, that is. She is fair-skinned, a quality that comports charmingly with the African element in the admixture of her beauty. Shortly after she graduated from high school, one of her friends moved to Brooklyn, New York, and invited her to come out for a visit. She went for a week and stayed 6. When she came back, her mother asked, "Holly, what happened to you?" "What do you mean, Ma? You have a Brooklyn accent." "Hey, cool, I didn't even know it." A few months after returning from Brooklyn, Holly went back for another visit. After a while, she decided to drive down to Atlanta to visit another friend who had moved down there. She invited a couple of new friends she had met in Brooklyn to accompany her. Being in an adventurous mood, they readily agreed. All went well until halfway there they ran out of gas in the middle of Tennessee. The first thing that occurred to Holly was that this was not a good place to run out of gas, considering the fact that her companions were a Puerto Rican who didn't speak English and a black guy in drag. The second thing that occurred to her was that they had to find some gas fast. There was a farmhouse about a quarter of a mile away. Holly spoke enough Spanish to tell the Puerto Rican, "Iré para la casa allí para comprar gasolina." She told the other guy the same thing in English. The farmhouse turned out to be deserted, and Holly turned back with a growing uneasiness in her mind, a feeling which was not alleviated by the sight of a highway patrol car which had pulled up behind them. The lawman and the guy in drag were engaged in an animated conversation. Holly's heart sank, but not for long. She had always been resilient, and before she reached the car, she already had an idea how to get them out of this. Before the patrolman could say a word to her, she walked up to him and said, "Officer, if you give us a gallon of gas, I promise you that we will leave Tennessee and never come back." It might have been her poise, it might have been her beauty, or it might have been the simple reasonableness of her request. But the totally bewildered lawman, without hesitating, went to the trunk, took out a gallon of gas, and poured it into their tank. As their car pulled away, they yelled, "Thank you," to the officer as he waved back to them and called out, "Sayonara!" This is John Morgan for Mind's Eye Radio.
As Esther Cameron implies, the famous poem If, while a cliché to some, has its own resilience by continuing to appeal to something important in the human soul, a desire to endure.
On the uses of poetry in adversity. One of the traditional uses of poetry is to buck people up when things have not gone as hoped. Given the frequency of such occasions in this life, it is not surprising that Psalms is the all-time poetry bestseller, or that a recent poll of British readers picked Kipling's If as the top favorite poem. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, yet make allowance for their doubting too. This poem annoyed me when I came across it in high school. I must have figured I wouldn't be needing its advice. In collegiate literary circles, I learned that to make a snide remark about Kipling's If established you as being in the know. But time passed, and one day in the 1980s, I saw a Hebrew translation of Kipling's If tacked to the wall of a Rebbetzin's kitchen in Jerusalem. And sometime early in this century, I found myself quoting it in an essay without irony. Another poem in a similar vein came my way in a college survey course on German literature. I seem to recall the professor mentioning that the 17th century author, Paul Fleming, wrote it after his fiancée married someone else. Over the years, I've kept in touch with this poem, and sometime in the 1990s found myself translating it. Being an archaism junkie, archaism speaks to me of permanence and endurance, I translated it into an English that is, I confess, slightly more antique than the original. The last word, leal, is an old Scottish form of loyal. Even now be undismayed, even now call loss a liar. Yield not to fortune's blows, leave envy far beneath. Of your own self be glad and count it not as grief, though time and space and fate against you should conspire. The sweet and bitter both accept as your own choice, as your own destined lot, and waste no thought on rue. Await no man's command to do what you must do. Each day shall bear new hope, at which you can rejoice. What use to praise and blame? His greatest woe and weal is each to his own self. Whatever you behold is all in you, from vain illusions disenthralled. Go inward first, before you take your outward way. Those who in their own souls hold undisputed sway, the world and all therein shall do them service leal. There's a third poem that stands next to If and the Fleming sonnet in my poetic medicine chest, though it may be famous only to me. I collected it from a co-worker on a clerical temp job in 1975. It appeared, under the pseudonym Alice Clark, in the one and only issue of a magazine, Chiroscura, that came out the following year, and I have recited it to myself at intervals ever since. For some reason, this poem was originally written in basic Spanish, and a curious feature is that it uses the formal you form, usted, as if to suggest an interrogation scene. ¿Qué hizo usted? Mucho. ¿Qué hizo usted? Traté. ¿Qué hizo usted? Nada. ¿Qué hizo usted? No sé. What did you do? Much. What did you do? I tried. What did you do? Nothing. What did you do? I don't know. The realization that we do not have a view of the scoreboard is unsettling, yet it is also bracing. It can help us try, at least, to meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two impostors just the same, as Kipling put it. Still holding on, I'm Esther Cameron for Mind's Eye Radio.
All broken hearts are the same, so says the voice on the radio. And one of the best ways to get busted is through loss, and maybe death, as E.E. Cummings said, to no parentheses. But the poet also said, though love be a day and life be nothing, it shall not stop kissing. Evie Thompson seems to understand this paradox.
The bus was barely moving. Katie leaned into the aisle to see out the front window. A long line of vehicles snaked forward as far as she could see. Probably another slowdown for construction. It was quiet in the bus. Most of the riders wore headphones, including the young man on her right. Although he didn't seem as relaxed as the others. The muscles in his face were tight, and his lips were pursed. She wondered if he was hearing the CD at all. Katie hated being held up. She leaned back and tried to see this as a chance to practice patience. Buses. They had been in her life at such critical times. There was the summer she left home to be an art counselor at a camp for underprivileged kids. She remembered the anticipation and excitement as she first got on the bus. The long ride. And the awful summer that ensued. Cold, not enough food, not enough arts and crafts supplies, and endless loneliness until she finally made friends. It rained for 3 days until the dining tent area flooded 2 inches deep in water. Well, she had survived, and the bus trip home was glorious. Bright sunlight, fields of corn stretching out to the horizon, and Mom and Dad so glad to see her. That summer changed her life. It nudged her into teaching, where she stayed for over 40 years. Without realizing it, Katie dozed off. The shush of the bus's air brakes woke her up, the fright of the nightmare still with her. In the dream, she'd been inching her way along a plank, across a black pit in a huge construction area. Katie looked around. She couldn't have been asleep for more than a few minutes because the bus was still creeping forward. Noticing that she was awake, the young man next to her slipped off his headphones and appeared ready to talk. "This is quite a traffic jam," Katie said. "I wonder what's holding things up." "I heard they're widening the road and replacing worn-out concrete up ahead. Boy, we picked some time to travel. Are you heading to the Twin Cities?" "Yes, I'm just coming back from visiting my daughter. How about you?" "I'm hoping to find work there." "What kind of work?" "Actually, I'm not too particular at this point. I just want to start over." "Oh? Yeah, well, my girlfriend and I are separating. I'd just like to get a fresh start." He stared out the window. "That's really tough," Katie said. "We just couldn't work things out, you know." Katie nodded. "How long were you together?"
3 years.
Katie wanted to say, "For goodness sake, don't give up. Go back and give it one more try." But she knew he didn't want to hear that. So instead she said, "I remember when Ben and I were married 3 years. That was the worst year ever. I'd gone into therapy,
and everything I'd been too polite or too inhibited to say before came out. I didn't do it in a nice way either. Remembering, she thought, that was a rough time. I was so proud of being able to express my anger. But it had been more like picking up the nearest verbal axe and chopping away. So, the two of you divorced? No, we came close, though. I went as far as getting in the car and driving off. Then I realized I really had nowhere that I wanted to go. And we'd purposely had no children at that point, but there was the cat. Who would take the cat? And the refrigerator my folks had given us. And all that. We got through it and things got better. Oh, here was the chance to say what she really wanted to tell him. You know, little by little you work out the details. Fix things around the edges. Choreograph your routines so that you work around each other's flaws. The young man remained silent, impassive. Oh, well, sometimes we're ready to hear something and sometimes we're not. Her thoughts turned to Ben. All those years together. He was the only person who knew all her faults and still cared about her. And now he was gone. What, just 6 months ago? It seemed like years. Katie's lip trembled. Oh, no, she thought, not this again. Please, Lord, don't let me cry. Outside the bus window, men were working on a large section of steel spikes and webs, and she could see a concrete paving machine moving slowly just beyond them. The bus had finally reached the construction site. That was what her life was like right now, torn up. But then she remembered her dream. Maybe it was not just ripped apart, but under construction. And, as in the dream, just inching her way along might be enough. The cars ahead were finally spreading out over both lanes, and the bus picked up speed. She looked at her seatmate. "Here we go," she said. He smiled at her and returned to his headphones. This is Evie Thompson from Mind's Eye Radio.
But maybe there's been enough meandering around in the airy nothings of emotion, eh? Perhaps we should check with the inimitable and illustrious Dr. Stringlove for a more stringent definition.
Hello, Dr. Stringlove here. I know you want a lecture on Jung's modulus, van der Waals forces, and related topics, but I refer to the literature for their elaboration. I shall deal with more prosaic subjects and draw on tenable analogies. As is obvious, an ordinary object is an equilibrium between attractive and repulsive forces acting on it and in its interior. Energy has to be applied to change its shape. For example, you can pull taffy or squash a grape. You might think that the same amount of energy would return the object to its original form, but the second law of thermodynamics wags its finger to point out that this won't happen. You can probably get the taffy back into the pan if you don't wait too long, but lots of luck with making the squash grape look as good as new. Similarly, it is unlikely that a personal relationship which is sweetened or soured will return to its original state with effort or lack thereof. Returning to objects, some when stretched or compressed from equilibrium, will try to return to their original shape as the internal attractive or repulsive forces take over. We say that such material is resilient or elastic. Steel is very elastic by this definition, and thus is a material of choice for many heavy-duty construction projects, such as ships, bridges, and skyscrapers. Some equilibrium is almost paradoxical. In the nucleus of an atom, the mutually repulsive protons are held together by what is called the strong force. The nucleus is sort of like a committee which performs its functions even though the members don't like each other very much. As you know, splitting atomic nuclei can yield enough energy to generate electricity or cause grief. In ordinary life, resilience is admired as the ability to bounce back from adversity. Unfortunately, as the case of steel shows, there is a breaking point even for the most elastic materials. It's better to be sweet like taffy and not wind up as a squash grape. This is Dr. Stringlove bouncing back on Mind's Eye Radio.
When the item that's asked to recover is part of one's initiation into the world of working men, Guy Thorvaldsen can attest to how it can cause a guy to focus.
Today I join them, the old squareheads. My father, Ernst, the carpenter. His brother, Johann, the shipwright. Their father, Morten, the steeplejack. Their blood wells up like ruby oil, lapping the rim of a 4-inch gash, sliced deep into my right palm. Triumph and fear invade me as I hit the red off switch with my elbow, mitigate the primitive scream of the pulsing table saw. I sink slowly to the ground, realize I have time before the rage of pain strikes my hand like a snake. Around me, the cool valley air falls mute, waits, then sighs, a hiss of dry oak leaves whispering old names. The ancient ones, stubbornly decorated men with thick Norwegian tongues, always tougher than me, their muscles like underground ropes working block and tackle hands, their coarse bodies embellished, not with tattooed ladies or hearts, but thin, ghostly pale etchings hardened into wistful sweeps and arches, matching the shape of blades, hatchets, draw knives, bow saws. Remember, Dad would say, nodding his stubbled chin, when you get cut, tell the doc it doesn't matter what it looks like, long as it works. So I allow one more look, snow-white bone and sinew peek through the pond of red. So this is who we are beneath the bulky overalls, the daily veil of alcohol and cigarettes. Tender children, pure, vulnerable. I clench the scene closed with thumb and forefinger, the vicarious son no longer. Like a soldier, I cradle my right hand in my left, stand and go for help. Tonight I will call my father, tell him the story nonchalantly, count out the stitches, cover the sound of my proud heart racing. Of course I will predict my early return to work, then I will listen closely to him, to his storied wounds, the ones I know by heart, and now by another, more sacred name. We will smile at each other over the phone. And perhaps later in the privacy of night, we will both dream of swimming in a calm magenta sea, held closely in the swell of our mothers, a warm sun measuring, slightly easing, the sharp edge of our brows. This is Guy Thorvaldsen for Mind's Eye Radio.
Judah Zuckerman confirms E.E. Cummings' sentiments in Love and in Death.
In 17 months, I have danced with death, whirled her off stage with surgery for an aneurysm, though she may still be waiting in the wings. Weeks ago, I mobilized a friend to drive me 5 hours to Wisconsin's northern woods to reach my lifelong partner playing recorder at the clearing, a folk school, where he loved 9-mile bike rides every afternoon. A pneumonia diagnosis at the local clinic laid him low until I drove him to our hometown hospital to survive a night where his heart, working at 10%, had him staring death in the face. Doctors and nurses danced in harmony in Baroque time. Nothing dramatic could be done. They listened to each other. Each small act helped his organs respond. His heart with collateral flow, his heroic heart, we called it, kept him going to sing, to play recorder, to perhaps ride his bicycle one day. Only 2 months later, he flew to the Netherlands to give a conference keynote address and to walk Amsterdam streets in our old neighborhood, which he loves. Resilience, one woman's story. For 6 months, she had no money in her house, yet she kept her 10 children fed. She grew food, canning, preserving for the Wisconsin winter. She harvested wild apples from nearby hillsides. She butchered animals for neighbors, bringing home slabs of pork and lamb as pay. Smart but poor, she dreamed of going to the university. Now years have passed. 8 children have grown and left home. May her resilience help her find a way. This is Judith Zuckerman for Mind's Eye Radio.
You confess that where you're from, there are folks that miss you. But you don't want to talk about that now. You only say sin is not as guilty as you once thought. And what's the use in placing blame anyhow? Sarah Ann, you don't have to be tied to your past. You can't regain the innocence you lost. You have questions you're no longer afraid to ask. You no longer believe everything you were taught. You say back home your parents only miss their little girl who shared all their views on country, God, and sin. Not the woman who doesn't judge someone for who they love and knows that colors can blend skin on skin. Sarah Ann, you don't have to be tied to your past. You can't regain the innocence you lost. You have questions you're no longer afraid to ask. You no longer believe everything you were taught. And if the way you choose to live conflicts with beliefs you grew up with, I think you know the advice I would give. You confess there are things you miss about your family, and sometimes wish you could go back and just fit in. But you know you can't give up the woman you become. If you can't be accepted, you won't ask to be forgiven. Sarah Ann, you don't have to be tied to your past. You can't regain the innocence you lost. You have questions you're no longer afraid to ask. You no longer believe everything you were taught. You no longer believe everything you were taught.
This is Lynn Patrick Smith for Mind's Eye Radio.
One person's weed is another person's posy, or so posits Paul Thompson, the proliferator of poetry.
For resilience, consider the low dandelion that blooms with the violets in May. Clockflower, some call it, due to its habit of closing up late in the day. It also will close when the sky turns to rain, but opens once more with the sun. And with its companion, it transmutes to gold our meadows and roadside and lawn. Most people consider this flower a pest, but it's hard to get rid of, with root going deep. People use poison to blast out this herb. The thoughts of such death makes me weep. So common but fair, this humblest of plants, like a prospector carrying his poke, secretes in itself certain healing balms of interest to medical folk. Diuretics, the term any doctor would use, but in words more familiar, its tea, if imbibed with abandon, is likely to cause you to run to the John for a pee. Herbalists know this democrat plant, plucked while its leaves are still tender, makes a fine salad, and the light amber wine from its blossom is good for a bender. The flower is actually many in one, a fine smorgasbord for the crowd, spread a few days and then closed away till the seed head unfurls its cloud. Along comes a breeze, and the children are off, released from the matronly tether. Where each one goes, the Lord only knows. They're entrusted to wind and the weather. We see them arise, swirling high in the air, and then they are dwindled and gone, alighting perhaps on a sparse rocky slope or finding our neighbor's lush lawn. Wherever they go, we know that they'll flourish, though the climate grow hotter or colder. As for me, I'll not injure my brave dandelions, though my neighbor may grimace and smolder. This is Paul Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
For Louise Mancuso, resilience has had to last a lifetime and is symbolized by the vision of a small black pot.
My mother looks down from the second-story window where she can keep an eye on me in the backyard. I am in seventh grade. It's after school Wednesday, and I'm sawing a plank of wood placed over two spread-apart sawhorses under the tutelage of our downstairs neighbor, Peep, really Pietro, the husband of large, sweet-faced Mariana, who always asks how I am in her broken English whenever she sees me. Having been born and raised on a farm in Italy, Mariana finds it difficult living in a city like this. But she still does some farm things, like killing live chickens she brings home from the market before putting them on to stew. I watched her one time, wringing a chicken's neck. "You like blood soup?" she asked me. I made a face and told her I never had it. "I give you some," she said, slitting the chicken's throat and catching the blood in a small black pot that was sitting on the ground. I turned my head away, gagging. But today I am helping Peep saw wood. His wife is away for the afternoon, visiting Mrs. Costello, four blocks away, who's sick, and my mother is rapping on the window. We both look up as she raises the sash and says to Peep he shouldn't be holding me like that. I'm wondering what she means, because Peep is only standing behind me, showing me how to hold the saw, working it back and forth in a rhythm slow and easy so the teeth do all the work. My mother asks me if I'm okay, and I tell her sure, wondering what her concern could be. Peep says, "What's the matter? I'm showing her how to saw wood." And my mother says, "Just remember, I'm keeping my eye on you." Peep shrugs and we go back to the sawing, only this time I'm doing it under my own steam. A half hour later, my mother comes downstairs and asks me if I want to go to the store with her. She has to pick up a few things for supper, but I tell her no, that I'd rather keep on sawing the boards with Peep. Peep is smiling, and my mother points a finger at him, giving him a look that makes him lower his head and start muttering to himself. When she goes, we continue to saw the boards Peep says he will use to make a coop so Mariana can raise her own chickens, like my grandpa next door raises pigeons. After some minutes, Peep tells me there is something in the woodshed he has to show me, and says for me to go on ahead and wait for him. Well, that old woodshed is just about pitch black with no light in it, except for what comes from large cracks in the wood. So we always keep the door open, and no one ever goes in there after dark for anything. My father saw a rat big as a small rabbit in there one time when he went to get oil for our stove, and my mother said, "That was that." I'm thinking Peep wants to show me something that has to do with building Mariana's chicken coop. So I go over to the shed and walk in, propping the door open with a stone. I can smell the oil drips and sawn wood piled in one corner. Then Peep comes in behind me, kicking the stone out from under the door. Right away it gets black as the sticky tar the city spreads on our dirt street that runs right up to the steel plant, and I ask Peep what he's doing. How can he show me anything with the door shut like that? He says, "Shh, it's okay. It's right here what I have to show you." He's breathing real hard, and I'm wondering why, because he wasn't doing that when he was sawing. I still can't see anything, just the cracks in the wood. But I know that Peep is holding something in his hand I can't quite make out. "What's that?" I say. "A piece of wood? I have to open a door so I can see." I start to go past him, but he takes my arm and says, "No, shh, leave the door shut. Here, I have something for you." My eyes are beginning to grow accustomed to the dark. I can see now that Peep is indeed holding something, but it's not a piece of wood. It's light-colored and smooth, something he's holding with two hands, but not able to lift higher than his waist. It takes a while for things to dawn on me sometimes, and the rest of my body reacts before this brain of mine lets me know what's going on. Out of the blue, I give a yell and push on past old Peep, grabbing the wooden latch and throwing it up to unlock the door. Man, I'm out of there so fast even Alice DiMaggio, first on our school's track team, couldn't catch me. I don't stop when I get out the door either. I make it down to the street corner and stand there puffing all out of breath. I stay maybe 10 minutes, giving Peep time to put his stuff away so I can get on back to the house before my mother. I'm a little scared, but I know Peep won't try anything again, because he'd be scared I'd say something to my mother, or Mariana. Man, I can just see old Peep, his scrawny neck being twisted in Mariana's big hands, and her telling me to pick up the knife and slit that old rooster's throat, being careful to catch every drop of his mangy old blood in a small black pot. He'd better watch out, that chicken poop Pete, because me and my mother, we're keeping our eye on him. This is Louise Mancuso from Mind's Eye Radio.
Lest we become all swollen up like happy ticks with our own success and elasticity, our abilities to be that bobbling bozo, that bobbing cork, let's recall that scientists now also believe that a certain amount of resiliency is not exactly earned, except by choosing your parents carefully. Studies conducted by Yale and Harvard indicate that at least some of the ability to bounce instead of going flat is inborn. Some people are naturally more resilient, says Robert Brooks of Harvard, co-author of The Power of Resilience. They stay connected, they're spiritual, they know how to play, they pick their battles, and they stay healthy as a result. Or, put more poetically, they're like trees bending in the wind but bouncing back, says Dr. Stephen M. Southwick. So the answer, my friends, is, as Bob Dylan might say, blowing in the wind. And when the bough breaks, perhaps the baby does not have to fall all the way down. Mind's Eye writers today included Darla Barclay, Esther Cameron, Louise Mancuso, John Morgan, Norma Gay Pruitt, Fran Rawl, Louis Rawl, Evie Thompson, Paul Thompson, Guy Thorvaldsen, and Judith Zuckerman, and Bob Zimmerman. Till next time, may your open mind and open heart endure. For Mind's Eye Radio, this is Greg Willard.